to this episode of the Insights Podcast on Acadia Broadcasting Network. I'm Don Mills.
And I'm David Campbell.
David, I'm sorry you weren't able to join the conversation with Dan Kelly, the president and CEO of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. I understand that you were in a dermatologist's office waiting to see that dermatologist, one of the issues that we have with our healthcare system, but that's another story for another day.
That's right.
Anyway, yeah, great conversation. A lot of people don't understand how important small business businesses are to the Canadian economy. Dan was telling me that small businesses in Canada represent about 60% of the employment in Canada and about half the GDP. So it's an important segment, and their organization is all about advocating for that that segment. There are about 1.2 million small businesses, small and medium-sized businesses in Canada currently, and another 2.5 million sole proprietorships. So that means people working as an independent consultant or whatever. So, you know, it's a pretty important segment in the economy, and, you know, their whole mandate is mandate for this segment. Like unions do, and other organizations for their segments.
Well, and you were telling me he's got CFIB has nearly 10% of those SMEs as members, right? If they've got 100,000 members.
Yeah, no, it's probably one of the biggest organized associations in Canada. They're just about to cross over the 100,000 member mark, and they have a big staff as well, nearly 400 employees working for CFIB across the country, of course supporting their advocacy programs and working with their members to address their issues. So it's a big organization, focused on a couple of key areas. One of the things that we talked about, and this is one of our issues, is the whole issue of regulatory environments that people have to work in. Red tape is a big focus for them. They have the Golden Scissor Awards that they present every year. The region actually got recognized for their physician registry in the most recent one. And he was pointing out that Nova Scotia is actually a bit of a leader in red tape reduction, which was good news in this region. And one of the reasons that it has been is that they actually have been focused on it as a priority. In fact, he was gave a couple of examples. They have a deputy minister who's responsible for red tape reduction, one of the few in the country that have people assigned to it. It's on their agenda at cabinet meetings, every meeting. And one of the things that they've done that is really important is that they've actually got an inventory of regulations. So they know how many there are in existence. And so Kelly was saying that you have to start with having a greater awareness of what the actual regulatory burden really is. And if you don't, it's kind of like, working in the dark. But he also pointed out that during the Harper years, the Harper government did a pretty good job at looking at this issue. It's fallen off since then, of course. But they had at least a plan where if they added a regulation, they had to take one away. So, in other words, the burden was not growing. And I guess, you could almost advocate that maybe we should institutionalize that idea and maybe even increase it. For every one you add, take away two for a while until you get the burden down overall. But that was a really interesting part of the conversation.
Well, I think maybe they should appoint you as Deputy Minister of Red Tape Reduction, and we'd get three gone for every one new one. No, I think that makes sense. I don't. We've been talking about it in New Brunswick for years, right? There have been red tape committees. There's been red tape efforts. Even Susan Holt, when she was in government, was in charge of trying to reduce red tape. But we don't score as high in this province as Nova Scotia does in terms of actual efforts. So it would be interesting at some point in the future to try and understand the difference between the two provinces, or are there ways that we can learn in New Brunswick and PEI around what they're doing in Nova Scotia? But you also talked about succession planning and some pretty stark numbers there as well.
Yeah, and I was stunned by the numbers. And one of the things that CFIB do really well is they do a ton of research with their membership. So they have a lot of data. One of the pieces of data that he mentioned to me, we talked about the generational shift in ownership of small businesses across this country, is that there's an expected 76% of small businesses, think about it, 76% expect to exit their businesses in the next 10 years. That's an enormous number. I don't know where the buyers are going to come from, honestly. That represents a transfer of about $2 trillion of business assets over a 10-year period. There's some opportunity in that, of course, but there's also challenges to that. And the one thing that he pointed out, and we talked about this before with Rob Normando especially, is that most of these small and medium-sized businesses are unprepared for that exit from their business. In fact, he said only about 1 in 10 actually have prepared a formal exit plan. So this is a big challenge for small and medium-sized businesses. And it's not that difficult to do, but you do have to focus attention on it. And it doesn't happen overnight, as we talked about in the past. So that was a really interesting part of the discussion as well.
Yep, it's an important, vitally important issue, and we'll be talking about it more on Insights as the weeks and months unfold. But it's because if we don't have proper succession planning and proper business succession, some of that 2 million will disappear because you're not properly maximizing the potential exit value of your firm. And we have to think about immigration as a source of potential entrepreneurs, along with encouraging New Brunswickers to step up and or Atlantic Canadians to step up and look at business ownership.
And one other issue I just want to mention before we get into that conversation with Dan Kelly is that the CERBA program that was used to support businesses during COVID is now coming home to roost. There's a lot of people who are unable to pay that back. In fact, between 2022 and 2023, there was a shrinkage in the number of businesses actually in the small business sector for, I think, the first time in the history of tracking this. And there was a 41% increase in the number of bankruptcies in that 1 year period. So we're not fully through the impact of COVID. He expects those numbers to remain high for a while. In fact, he said there were, over 200,000 businesses that had to go out and take a bank loan to pay off their CEBA loan. So that is something that is still flushing itself through the system, and we're going to see continuing impacts of COVID for a while at least. So a very interesting conversation, a very important segment of our economy. And with that introduction, here's my conversation with Dan Kelly, the President and CEO of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. We are pleased to have Dan Kelly, President and CEO of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, join us today on the Insights podcast to talk about a wide range of issues impacting small businesses, from red tape reduction to population growth. Welcome to the podcast, Dan.
Good to be with you, Don.
So before we start talking about some of the interesting research published recently by CFIB, I'd like to give our listeners an overview of your background. Can you tell us kind of your career path to your present role as CEO of CFIB?
Yeah, I sure can. Look, it is interesting timing for you to ask in that I think it's this month I'm celebrating my 30th anniversary with CFIB, one organization
Wow.
for 30 years,
That's
but in a lot of different roles. I started off as a policy analyst, the most junior legislative position we had in Winnipeg, where I grew up. Prior to that, I worked. I studied business at university and then worked in politics. Like many people running advocacy-based organizations, I worked for a provincial premier at the time, a conservative premier for a number of years as a policy advisor, at a very young age, as is often the case with young
Right.
political staffers. Learned a little bit about the inner workings of government, obviously studied business at school, and those two things tended to set me up pretty well to come and work for an association that serves small and medium-sized businesses. So I started off as a policy analyst, moved to Calgary for about a decade with CFIB, then to Ottawa for a few years. And then when Catherine Swift, my predecessor, was retiring, a few of us were put on a succession path, and I got the nod. So that's what led me. I've been president now for about 12 years, which is pretty amazing.
Well, congrats on that. That's a great tenure for sure. So we want to talk about CFIB a little bit. Not everybody will be fully aware of, sure, of what the organization is about. Can you talk about its role and perhaps the membership side a little bit, and also the staffing and governance model that you have?
Fantastic. Happy to do that. CFIB was founded 52 years ago by John Bullock. I'm the third president in the organization's history. So the top job, it doesn't turn over very often. John Bullock, then Catherine Swift, now me as president. John set us up based on a tax protest at the time. There was a white paper, it was a Liberal government in Ottawa at the time. And there was a white paper that was put out that in fact proposed to raise the rate of taxation on small companies to 50% higher. Yes. Higher than the rate that was charged to large businesses at the time. And John realized that if you're not at the table, as the saying goes, you become lunch. And so he wanted to make sure that there was a bit of an equalizing force in Canada within the business community. And our job was really to help balance the scales between big business, big governments, and big unions, which really those three groups called all the shots. Wanted to make sure that small firms had sometimes a unique voice to put forward and set up an organization to do just that. Since then, we have grown rapidly. We now have, in fact, we had 97,000 members last year, and we are very close, just a few hundred away from hitting 100,000 members across the country. All of those members are small and medium-sized, independently owned and operated businesses. So there are no publicly traded corporations as part of CFIB. They're actually barred from membership. We do have, of course, some franchises. So there might be a McDonald's of Canada franchisee that is owned by Bob and Mary that is a member of CFIB. But most of our members are pure independent businesses operating with a single location somewhere in the country. We are a fairly large, though, association. We have 400 staff across Canada. About half of those work in membership development. They go out and visit business owners, which is our source of revenue. People pay us a membership fee, typically a few hundred dollars to, maybe $1,000. That's their membership fee for the year, which is 97% of our overall funding to the Federation. We take no money from governments. And so that allows us to be pure independent voices for small firms. Advocacy is the largest and most, and the thing we're best known for, where we lobby governments and, of course, use the media to try to, share the views and opinions of small business owners. The other two big things that we do are we negotiate a bunch of savings programs for small business owners that to help them save money on things like credit card processing, insurance, and a few other areas. And the other big chapter is providing one-on-one advice to business owners through a facility that we've called HR Now. So a lot of those calls are related to HR. Most small businesses don't have a VP of HR. They're too small. Right. And so we provide them with back office support on things like, understanding statutory holiday rules or training programs for small firms, a whole bunch of government compliance and other things we help small business owners do.
That's a great summary. From a governance model point of view, you have a board of directors, do you not?
Is we do, yeah. So we have one board member for each province. In fact, we just last week had our spring board meeting in Toronto. And we have one small business owner, small or medium-sized business owner, from every province in the country on our board. And then they provide me with the direction in terms of where to take the organization. I will add, though, that our governors, we call them governors, our right. board, they don't get involved in determining the policy positions of CFIB on external issues. We do that through detailed member research. If you know anything about CFIB, you know that we survey the heck out of our members to try to gather their views and opinions, data from them as well, and then we present that to the public. So board members really focus on the governance of the organization, holding me accountable, but they don't get involved in determining our position on, say, workers' compensation reform in New Brunswick or tax policy at the federal level. That our general membership does through the survey process.
Yes, I was a member through my former company with CFIB. I remember all the surveys. There, you know, of course, I was in the survey business, so I supported that really.
Well, we like to joke that we criticize government for creating red tape and paper burden, but we create a bunch of paper burden for our members as well, in that we send them a bunch of surveys electronically, of course. But we do depend on the data that they share with us. And I got to tell you, during the pandemic, for example, had it not been for our research strength, I don't think any of the government support programs would either have existed or delivered in the way that they did. The federal government was desperate for data. We were able to turn it around within days. We were doing weekly surveys to try to find out what the impact of COVID restrictions were on small business owners. That just as an example, I have to admit, I'm incredibly proud of our research team that delivered week after week fantastic data that we were able to give to government. And you know, the federal government, who doesn't always love CFIB, they really did reach out in a big way. And I think the country was the better for it.
Yeah, just remind people how important small and medium-sized businesses are for in the economy. Can you give us a sort of the scale of importance of this sector?
Absolutely. Look, there are 1.2 million small and medium-sized companies in Canada with paid staff. When you include the self-employed in that mix, there's about another 2.5 million businesses, effectively, that are businesses of one. They together, self-employed and small business owners with paid staff, represent over half of the GDP in the country. 60% of total employment in the country is in small and medium-sized firms. And it is also often surprising that 98-99% of all businesses in Canada would be considered small or medium-sized. Typically, when we say small, we usually use a headcount indicator of 50 employees or fewer, medium-sized being 50 to 500, large enterprises being 500 plus. It's not that we have anything against large companies, although we do fight with them from time to time, like banks and insurance companies and others. But I will say their needs are just different. Small business owners operate differently than large publicly traded corporations. And there's some strengths, of course, of both, but there also are some weaknesses that we have to acknowledge as well.
And if I'm not mistaken, Dan, in Atlantic Canada, that proportion is slightly higher, isn't it? The number of small and medium-sized businesses.
Yeah, the smaller the province, the fewer large enterprises that are typically found. New Brunswick's a little bit different. There are a larger cross section of large corps as a percentage of the economy. But Atlantic Canada, you're right. Generally speaking. Has fewer large enterprises, more small and medium-sized companies. And of course, there's a whole bunch of strengths that come along with that for the province. One of the strengths, of course, of small businesses is when you hit tough economic times, small firms often operate as a bit of an insulating effect on the economy. They are a little bit slower to hire sometimes, but they're also a lot slower to fire. They don't say goodbye to staff. There isn't a quarterly earnings report that comes out and they say, even though we've got fantastic people, we got to let go 400 of them in order to meet this demand. And that sure does help in tougher times. Small firms keep them on even at the expense of the business owner's income from the firm often.
Yeah, no, that's a really excellent point. And just before we jump into some content that we want to talk about, what are your three big issues that you're dealing with right now?
Yeah, we just came out of, I had a lot more hair at the beginning of the pandemic than I do today. But we haven't seen the full washing out of the damage from pandemic restrictions on SMEs. Atlantic Canada was a little bit was impacted a little bit lighter from a business perspective because you didn't have within Atlantic Canada the length of the most vicious restrictions. There was obviously border protections and that had its own impact, but businesses weren't closed down for month on end in the same way that, say, Ontario businesses were. But the impact of pandemic restrictions is still washing through the economy right now. The huge uptick in business failures that we're seeing right now, 41% increase from 2022 to 2023, is in part for because of the lag effect of the pandemic damage that did happen. Businesses hung on, hoping for a brighter day, and are now at the point where they're saying they've run out of rope and they're closing down in huge numbers, which is a big worry. So we just finished a major campaign on the CEBA loan, the Canada Emergency Business Account loans, to try to get that deadline kicked back. We were successful on a couple of occasions, but the deadline has come and gone for most business owners, and we're still dealing with some after effects of that. Another big file for us right now is carbon-based taxation, not necessarily just the general unhappiness about carbon taxes that I think more Canadians are, you know, Canadians have really changed their views on this. And there's a lot more hardening of the heart and a lot more people in Canada that are unhappy about the carbon tax and its increase that's happening on April the 1st. But for small business owners, the big focus for us right now is some money that was set aside to be returned to small businesses that hasn't been. The federal government, when it set up the rebate structure for consumers, said that about 10% of the rebates would go back to SMEs and Indigenous groups, and then has sat on that money for five straight years. Atlantic Canada has just joined the fund of the rest of the country July 1st of last year. So now Atlantic businesses are experiencing the full weight of the federal carbon tax with its commensurate increase on April the 1st. Atlantic businesses are owed hundreds of millions of dollars right now in back rebates that have not happened. And that is one of our top budget requests in Ottawa. $2.5 billion is supposed to be returned to small firms. And Ottawa has been sitting on it since the creation of the carbon tax, either in the four Western provinces or in the four new Atlantic provinces that have joined the carbon tax. So those are two big files: pandemic aftermath, obviously the carbon tax that is very big. But growth is a huge deal for us. Like, the federal government has really not focused on Canada's economy or growth in a long, long time. There have been a few positive measures, including in the last budget, some measures to reduce credit card processing fees, which was a big file for us. That positive news is happening at the end of October, beginning of November. So that will be something that will be a good thing. But overall, Ottawa has been focused on dividing up the pie, not growing it. We're feeling it. We need to make sure that if we can finally get lower interest rates, we can then, let's hope, get the economy back into growth mode again, of which small businesses, can play a big, big part.
Okay, well, let's jump into some topics we thought would be helpful to explore. You recently announced your 2024 Golden Scissors Awards, I like that name, for regulatory modernization as part of the CFIB's 15th Annual Red Tape Awareness Week. We talk a lot about regulation on this podcast, so this is a good topic for us. Reducing red tape and the ease of doing business has been a theme of our podcast for a while. The Atlantic provinces were recognized for the Atlantic Physician Registry. Can you tell us about this project and why it made the cut?
Yeah, this was such a big win. And I will say Nova Scotia in particular has been just a real standout on regulatory reform, on red tape reduction. And this has lasted, luckily, over successive governments, successive political stripes. We're really, really proud of the work that the Nova Scotia government has been doing on this. Nova Scotia led a project a couple of years ago to look at do a deep dive on the amount of work that physicians do just completing paperwork. And it calculated that physicians in Nova Scotia really dedicated about a day per week. And this is not just their staff, but the physician, him or herself, on many of these forms that are required. So a day per week, 10.6 hours a week spent by a doctor or his or her staff to complete paperwork. That totaled up to 1.36 million hours that physicians are spending in Nova Scotia just completing paperwork. Physicians were asked how much of that, you know, we all recognize that some of it is critical and important for accountability reasons and obviously insurance and all sorts of other programs. But how much of it, they were asked how much of it they thought could be safely cut from the system. And the government then did some terrific work in lowering and scrapping unnecessary forms or consolidating forms so that you could tick if the information was the same instead of having to copy it from one document to the next. And that has effectively saved 1.3 million person visits of time for doctors just in Nova Scotia alone. Think about that.
Wow.
Almost 2 million new patient visits were permitted because Nova Scotia scaled back, not eliminated, but scaled back the amount of red tape. So Atlantic Canada has been looking at this. All four provinces have been involved in this. And so we wanted to compliment those four governments. And in fact, I was there, I think it was in New Brunswick. I gave the New Brunswick minister an award personally for the work that the government did. We did that with the other premiers to compliment them for taking this seriously and looking at how this could be applied across all four Atlantic provinces. We, as an advocacy organization, are trying to replicate that model in other provinces. Manitoba is taking this seriously right now, too. But these are the kinds of things that if we are successful, we can get more and more governments to jump on. And that's why we do this Golden Scissors Award. It shows us, it's actually a physical pair of scissors in a little statuette that sits on a minister's desk and reminds them that we can give them a compliment when they take on red tape work. You know, this stems from some analysis we've done over decades, having been with CFIB for 30 years. Every civil servant views as part of their job coming up with rules and regulations. It is kind of just a natural reflex within the bureaucracy to come up with rules. And of course, that's necessary in lots of situations. But if everybody's focused on just the creation of new rules, there is almost zero time that governments spend thinking about what rules already exist that could be scrapped. Everybody, there's a natural fear of getting rid of anything, any system or process in government. And so even when they move electronically, they try to recreate all of the paper-based regimes and just move it into an electronic format, thinking that that's somehow going to fix the problem. When really this needs to be rethought, governments need to say, okay, you know what? We need some new rules around water quality for water quality improvements in our province. But what rules could we scrap that are not being used, or forms that are just sitting in a dusty filing cabinet in some government office building and nobody's looked at them in 20 years? Like, those kinds of things exist. And so we've tried to create this positive, more virtuous circle to encourage governments to not just think about the new regulations, which of course they need to do, but to think about the burden that's already there, how we might be able to either simplify it or in some cases scrap some of the rules that are in place to equalize the incoming and outgoing regulations so that the business community and the public don't just feel like they're just continually getting overburdened.
So unfortunately, in general, the region scored quite poorly on your red tape report card. New Brunswick was given a C.
Yep.
PEI a C-. Newfoundland and Labrador an F. That's not good. The bright spot, as you mentioned, was Nova Scotia, ranking second among the 10 provinces with with an A grade. And to your point, this has been a focus of the Nova Scotia government for successive governments. So that's good news. And I think that's probably why they're doing as well as they are. But let's look at the other provinces a little bit. New Brunswick scored a particularly poorly on regulatory burden with a D grade. Is the province making any progress on any front? What are the key challenges for New Brunswick?
Yeah, there has been some. In fact, they went from a D to a C. So they're, you know, that New Brunswick is with a D grade. They are making a few strides to try to clean things up. One of the big gaps, though, in New Brunswick is the fact that there's no public feedback portal for red tape examples, problems to be raised with government. There hasn't really been a ton of political accountability on this file either. We know, though, that there is interest in some of it. Interprovincial cooperation also has been fairly low from a New Brunswick perspective, with a few exceptions. The Nova Scotia government really is the power behind the Atlantic Canadian work on red tape, but it is Nova Scotia that is driving the bus here. And it would be nice to have additional participation from some of the other Atlantic provinces. Getting New Brunswick's attention has been a bit of a struggle on this front, but there is some light at the end of the tunnel. We do think that they're starting to take this more seriously. And we've talked to Premier Higgs. I remember having a personal chat with him not that long ago about the Atlantic physician work. And of course, his government did participate in that over the course of last year.
Right. Prince Edward Island received a C- on all three main red tape areas: regulatory accountability, regulatory burden, and political priority. So what do they need to do?
You know, they do have some legislated constraints in PEI, which is a good thing. They've kind of got a middle of the road evaluation, but they don't have consistent reporting of the regulatory burden. And this is a really important point if you want to look at regulations kind of government-wide. It's easy to, you know, most governments, when they take office, if they do anything in red tape, they say, let's set up a process where the public can raise a few examples of problematic regulations and we'll look at those and maybe make some progress on them. And that's usually where it starts and stops. And that's not bad. That's a helpful part. We actually do ask governments to do some of that work. But often what happens is, let's say that there's six great examples that come through that process, and they put a team of bureaucrats together with political leadership to try to get rid of or fix those six areas. Meanwhile, while they're fixing those six areas, there are 600 new regulations that do pop up. And so the burden that the public feels, the businesses feel, never actually starts to go down, because, you know, there are more new regulations than there are fixes to existing ones. This is one of the reasons why we urge government, if they're, you know, especially a new government, to start by measuring how many rules and regulations are out there. And typically when governments do that, they come up with totals that boggle the mind, somewhere at a provincial level, somewhere between 50,000 and 250,000 regulations, rules that exist that the public and businesses are expected to know and comply with. And I got to tell you, if a business owner were able to perfectly implement 250 regulations, I would be pretty impressed. Meanwhile, there are actually 250,000 regulations in many provinces, which means that, you know, I start from the contention that an inspector could go into any business anywhere in Canada and likely walk out with a couple of hundred violations, not because the business owner isn't taking things seriously, but they just can't keep up with the volume that a government is expecting them to. And that's one of the problems. So Nova Scotia, PEI, to your question, doesn't really have a system to consistently report on the regulatory burden that it imposes on the public. And that's the chief flaw in their system.
Now let's turn to Newfoundland and Labrador, which received an F grade on regulatory accountability and regulatory burden and a D on political priority.
Yeah.
So again, the question is, what do they need to do to improve?
Well, first they need to admit that it's a problem. I mean, this has been a struggle to get any attention on regulatory reform in Newfoundland and Labrador for some time. That government has been particular, and again, over successive governments, successive premiers, we've not been able to get a point of purchase to get much attention to this. Now, that is starting to change, and we were actually quite positive. Just in last week's provincial budget, there was a focus put on regulatory reform. And that's really why we're doing a lot of this work and shining spotlights. We do this report card in order to compliment governments that are doing positive things and shame governments that are not. And it seems to be working because Newfoundland and Labrador does seem to be having a renewed commitment. And of course, they did participate in the Atlantic physician work, and we complimented them for that.
Probably helps that they had a surgeon as their premier on that file, I guess.
That's super helpful because he would know where some of the problems are.
Yeah. When you're advising governments in this region, is it as simple as saying, do what Nova Scotia does? That probably doesn't go over well in this region, but, are things actually getting better since during your time as CFIB? Have we seen some improvements that are, serious?
Yeah. I think we are in a few areas. One of the things that I think has been a big change is that there is a greater awareness of the problem of overregulation. And the nice thing is that this doesn't need to be a partisan issue. It is, we've been as successful with some conservative governments as we have with NDP and liberal governments. We're actually pleased. The NDP in British Columbia really kept a lot of the previous government's work. And right now in Nova Scotia, going from liberal to conservative, the same thing. The government has kept up some of the work and is improving on those processes. Nova Scotia has a really interesting model. One of the things that they do really well is they actually look at the overall regulatory burden on a cost for cost basis. So when they're looking at a new regulation, they say, okay, how much is this going to cost both government and the public to comply with? And if they're creating a new regulation with, let's say $200,000 worth of new cost to the system, they then look for $200,000 in costs that they can take out of the system and keep the regulatory burden balanced in that fashion. Other provinces have done this on just a pure count basis. For every new rule, they get rid of one, or every new rule, they get rid of two. That one for one rule was adopted by the Harper government federally. And to be fair, the Liberals did keep it when they took office federally. But we need to make sure what Nova Scotia really does well is it also has, this is right at the top of the list. The premier is conscious of this. And they put in place restrictions like in BC when they did some great work on this with the Liberal government decades ago, they actually had cabinet meeting time that was dedicated to looking at the count of regulations by department. And then there were political rewards for keeping that in check or in some cases lowering it. Nova Scotia has a full deputy minister focused on this. Fred Crooks, just a fantastic leader in Nova Scotia that is keeping this agenda front and center and is also looking for new examples that he and his team can delve into. That's been a big piece of this. You got to build it into the bureaucracy because if it's just, let's say every MLA was dedicated full-time to regulatory reform. Well, if there's 50 or 80 MLAs, they certainly couldn't try to go up against the weight of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of civil servants who view this as part of their job to create regulations. That's why we need to make sure that we institutionalize this, build it into the bureaucracy so that all civil servants are rewarded for regulatory management, not just regulatory creation.
Right. Before we leave this topic, I have to ask you about the federal government, which CIB stated takes the triple crown for most absurd regulations. I can attest to that, frankly. I agree with that. Can you tell our listeners about the triple crown and what you would like to see from the federal government that would, when it comes to red tape reduction?
Well, look, we have struggled on this front with the feds. They did keep in place the one-for-one rule. They kept some of the infrastructure that the Harper government, that we spent years lobbying the Harper government to build. But red tape reform, I got to say, has not been a particular focus. Scott Bryson, when he was Minister of Treasury Board, he or President of Treasury Board, he did some good work on this front. But it really has slipped down the priority list of this government. I will say Anita Anand, we've had some good meetings with her that suggest that there may be some new eyes, fresh eyes taken to this. The Fed seem pretty committed to interprovincial regulatory reduction, which is another big chapter that needs to be thought of. But on our red tape, like our paperweight awards that we issued for the worst examples of red tape, yeah, the Fed's got three of those. One for they changed the classification for some sort of for costumes that are imported for Halloween and other events, and so we had small business owners that were facing $100,000 in fresh duty fees because they changed the wording of the classification of costumes with no consultation. It also set up is that some of the big guys like Walmart and Costco were able to stick with the old classification and pay no import duties, whereas small firms that were focused on this area, they had to pay them. So very little focus on how the disproportionate impact that had on small firms. Secondly, Health Canada has been working on some new regulations for natural health products that really seem like an overreach. I don't think anybody objects to some light regulation of this sector, but my goodness, they're going with the full heavy hand as if these are pharmaceutical products. And third, you know, often these are things that are born out of good intentions, but the federal government is putting in place some new rules for money laundering about terrorist financing. But they've done that in such a way that now there are a whole bunch of new regulations that small firms that use a payroll company to pay their employees have to go through a bunch of new hoops that really haven't been thought through. And that has caused a whole bunch of new paperwork burden for small firms and the payroll companies that work on their behalf, especially as they convert to digital options. So these are three examples that we were highlighting during Red Tape Awareness Week in January of problematic regulations. And that really does help us in getting some action on some of these key files.
Let's turn to the state of small business in Canada these days. Your Business Barometer survey seems to indicate small business confidence is still below the level before the pandemic, going back to the recession actually of 2008. That's a long time ago now. Interestingly, Prince Edward Island and Newfoundland and Labrador ranked first and second among the 10 provinces for small business confidence in January. Any thoughts to what is driving the confidence of these two provinces? We're not surprised about PEI because we have noticed that PEI is outperforming the rest of the region, both in job growth and economic growth for the last quite a period of time. But is there anything else driving that confidence?
You know, we always have to be cautious when we're talking about PEI, Newfoundland and Labrador, from a sample size perspective. So I just would add that as a bit of a caveat that our sample sizes included tend to be a little bit smaller when we talk about smaller provinces. But you're quite right. PEI has been on a bit of a tear for a whole bunch of reasons. I think the pandemic, generally speaking, has been there has been some positive outcomes for Atlantic Canada. From that, with more Canadians looking to go back to perhaps the region that they may have been from originally, leaving big city life in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver behind. So that has been, in some cases, a positive momentum, with business owners sometimes going back, setting up businesses in provinces that they may have had some historic connection to. So that has helped, I think, in some cases, and in Newfoundland and Labrador's perspective, when the resource industries were hurting, some of the people started going home. I wouldn't say that there's any one thing that these two provinces have done, but it does seem like it has been their turn to see a bit more economic growth that is happening, and that's a nice thing. It's good to see that happening. It certainly is long overdue in much of Atlantic Canada to see this growth. And remember, we also have to keep in mind that, there are other, sometimes the relative growth looks good because other provinces are in worse shape. And there have been some pretty hard hits in parts of the economy. I will add, during the pandemic, here in Ontario, where I live, I'm from Winnipeg originally, but here in Ontario, where I live presently, Ontario had the longest lockdowns in the entire world, not just in Canada, but restaurants and gyms were closed for 430 days in parts of Ontario. 430 days just shut down. That economic impact has just has not gone away. On the CEBA loan, for example, yes, the federal government was successful in getting about 80% of CEBA loan holders repaid their loan by the deadline. But some of them did that by taking out a bank loan to repay their CEBA loan. So the debt just basically went from the federal government to a bank, but the business is as indebted as they were. That's what we're facing right now. A lot of business owners are worried about how long they're going to continue to outrun their debt. And we haven't seen that wash through the entire economy. Some of the lighter restrictions that existed in Atlantic Canada really did save some businesses that would not have survived had they had the restrictions that we saw in Ontario and to a degree in Quebec.
On the flip side, New Brunswick has ranked last in small business confidence recently and over a 12-month period, actually. So any thoughts about what might be driving the pessimism in New Brunswick? I know, again, sample size has meaning here, but they've held that distinction for 12 months, so it's been over a period of time.
Look, we were quite disappointed in the most recent New Brunswick budget. There was nothing in it for small firms, no reasons to be more optimistic from a provincial perspective, no tax relief. That was disappointing to see. New Brunswick has certainly been struggling from that perspective. We have a healthy sample in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. We have lots of members in those two provinces in particular. In fact, more as a percentage of the population than we do in most provinces. So sample size is less of an issue for us in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, but confidence in New Brunswick has been pretty poor. One of the bright spots, I will say, though, in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia in all of Atlantic Canada has been also international immigration. The Atlantic provinces really seem to be focused on getting both temporary and permanent residents boosted through international means. And that has been a real godsend for businesses in a whole bunch of sectors. We're really worried about the clamping down of international student visas, as well as some changes that were just announced that may lower the number of temporary foreign workers that can be used by businesses in these communities. We believe temporary foreign workers can be, if done correctly, this can be a pathway to permanent residency. And New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Atlantic more broadly, they've been doing some really interesting work to try to make sure that the benefits of international immigration are being experienced both within the business community and more broadly in the population.
In New Brunswick, small businesses have ranked shortage of skilled labor as the top limitation for growth. It's a problem right across the region, honestly.
It sure is.
We hear it everywhere. There was a podcast we did recently with a woman who's running a fintech company, and she actually said she has no problem finding people, which is good news. So it's not universal.
Right.
But I guess the question is really, is there a mismatch between the jobs available and the skills of the people moving into the region?
We've got both problems. We have a skills shortage, but we're also moving into areas of general labor shortages as well. And that's the piece that we at CFIB really try to make sure public policymakers are aware of. Yes, there's no question. We have lots of parts of the economy with fewer workers than are needed at all different levels. But, retail, hospitality, the service sector, arts and entertainment, these businesses, sadly, the ones that were most directly affected by pandemic restrictions, but coming out of the pandemic, these businesses had nobody. And we got to admit that we're not, encouraging in any way people to look at jobs in some of those more junior roles in the economy. We're upskilling the Canadian workforce in a huge way, and there's huge benefits of that. I'm not by any means suggesting that we stop trying to encourage higher levels of education. But at the same time, if we do that, if everybody wants their kids to have a university level education, Canada has among the highest degree of highest rate of post-secondary education in the entire world. It's no wonder that once you've done that, perhaps gone into debt to do that, you don't want the job in the local restaurant or retail store. And we're struggling to find the workers that we need. So it's the general labor shortage that are biting. And some of this, of course, is also employment insurance related. I can't tell you, still today, we have business owners that tell us that they are asked by their staff to lay them off so that they can collect employment insurance. We have pockets of that right across the country. This is, you know, EI rules. If we set that, we saw that during the pandemic with the CERB program, but if we set the level too low, we can in fact lock people into long-term unemployment because that's what they get used to. So we need to make sure that every single part of the Canadian labor force is fully tapped. We're doing a lot of work right now on seniors to try to get governments to reduce some of the barriers to getting seniors more employed. For example, making sure that the OAS transition doesn't get clawed back in if a senior starts to earn more income, promoting the fact that you can delay your CPP and continue to work. We're also suggesting the federal government that maybe EI rules change so that if you're if you're 65 or 70 and you want to go back and get a second job after you've retired from your first to work part-time, why do you need to pay into EI? And why does your employer need to pay into EI for you? You're not going to take a mat leave when you're 62. You're certainly, you know, if you've already been retired, you're drawing your CPP and OAS, you probably don't even need the EI, employment dislocation benefits that would come along with this. That money might be useful to you as an income. So we're giving the feds and provinces some ideas as to how we can tap existing labor pool better and at the same time continue to draw the benefits from our immigration scheme. But Atlantic has done a lot of work on immigration in recent days. That's been a big thing. So many small business owners are thinking about their own retirement, and international immigrants often come from entrepreneurial backgrounds. This is a great win-win. If we can make it happen, we just need to do more of it.
I want to just turn to your focus on this CEBA repayment program.
Yeah.
You know, obviously it's challenging for companies to figure out how to get through that. Can you give us an update on that file and where it is right now?
Yeah, the Canada Emergency Business Account loans, they were one of the very first COVID support programs that the federal government put in place. This provided originally a $40,000 loan to businesses during the pandemic to help them get through. That was later extended with a whole bunch of lobbying from our end to a $60,000 loan. The loans, you had a couple of years to repay the loan with no interest being charged. Originally, you were supposed to have it repaid by the end of 2022. If you did, you got a portion of that loan forgiven by Ottawa. So you took out a loan from your bank. The bank delivered it, but Ottawa backstopped it. If you took out $40,000, you could get $10,000 forgiven. If you took out $60,000, you could get $20,000 or a third of the loan forgiven if you repaid it successfully by the deadline. That deadline was extended from the end of 2022 to the end of 2023 because the pandemic lasted much longer than anyone anticipated. Unfortunately, while we lobbied hard to get the federal government to extend it another year, the feds only extended it a few days. They pushed it back to January 18th. We remain really worried about what happens to these businesses that are just not in a position to repay those loans. What has happened? Well, January 18th has come and gone just a couple months ago. The Fed said, as I noted earlier, 80% of CEBA loans were repaid by that deadline. So the business owner benefited from that forgivable portion. But to do that, if you can believe it, the official advice from Ottawa was, if you don't have enough money to repay your CEBA loan by the deadline, just go to your bank and borrow the money to repay your CEBA loan. So the advice was, if you don't have your money to repay it, borrow it from the bank and repay us. You get to keep the forgivable portion, but then you get locked into a higher rate of interest, and then you can pay it off over time. Sounds really good. And we just put out today new data that shows that 200,000 businesses had to take out a loan to repay their SBA loan. It's similar advice if we, you know, the federal government would have been pilloried if they had said, hey, Canadians, if you're struggling to repay your Visa bill, just go take out a MasterCard and repay the Visa with that. That's essentially what business owners have done. And I'm really worried about what's going to happen over the next couple of years as business owners struggle to repay the balance that they have on this amount. Where there's about another 6% of business owners, or about 50,000 businesses that have a SBA loan that are trying to qualify for a special extension that ends this week to March 28th to get that refinancing loan in place. So there's still a lot of pain that has yet to be felt. When I've talked about this with the Deputy Prime Minister, there's no question that there are some businesses that even with more time, these are zombie businesses. The damage has been done. They're not going to make it.
Right. Yeah.
Terrible for them, but that's not going to change. What I worry about, though, is that there are, and our data shows this, thousands, tens of thousands of businesses that have viable models, have made tons of changes to try to get their, you know, business in shape. And if it weren't for the debt that they had to take on during the pandemic, they would be able to live another day. That's the group that I think we should worry about, are viable businesses that are just underwater from the debt that they've had to take on. We estimate that there are tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of businesses in that category. The average small firm took on over $100,000 in debt. So not just the SBA loan, but private debt, just to keep the lights on. And, you know, My organization has had a history of never calling for business subsidies. We generally view subsidy programs for small businesses as rewarding only those that are really good at, we call them grantrepreneurs, only those that are really good at applying for government loans. They use all the right buzzwords to get whatever access to whatever program is out there. The reason we pivoted and called for supports, both subsidy programs, loan programs during the pandemic, it's because governments told businesses you weren't able to earn an income from the marketplace. And so it was really unfair to say, sorry, you can't serve your customers. And yet the cost of that, we're going to throw on your backs alone. That's why we did call for COVID support programs to help small businesses get through to the other side. I just don't think we're past that point, sadly. I want to stop talking about COVID desperately, but the damage has been so significant for so many businesses that we're continuing to advocate for relief from some of the debt that businesses were forced to take on.
And I'm assuming we're seeing a higher rate of bankruptcies.
41% increase from 2022 to 2023. And we're pretty confident that the worst has not been experienced yet. There are a lot of businesses that we expect to fold in the months ahead because they realize that there's no way that they're going to unbury themselves from the debt they had to take on. And that's a shame.
Right. We're kind of running short of time, but there are a couple of questions I want your opinion
sure.
on. One big one that I think is really unreported or underreported is the generational change of business ownership underway in Canada. You know, I'm a baby boomer. You know, I sold my business recently. I'm in the early edge of the baby boomers, but there's lots of other baby boomers who own businesses. I'm sure you've studied this issue among your members. Can you give us an idea of how many businesses are expected to change hands over the next 10 years? And also, I know you've done research on this. Are business owners really prepared for that transition?
We've done tons of work in this area, and it is a big worry for us as an organization that serves small businesses, a big worry for us, but it should be a big worry for public policymakers more broadly. If you can believe it, 76% of small business owners plan to exit their business within the next decade. 76%.
Wow.
That is such a huge number. $2 trillion worth of business assets could change hands over the course of that decade, of the next decade. And to your point about how prepared businesses are, sadly, not so prepared. only 1 in 10 businesses, about 9% of them, have a formal succession plan in place. That's deeply worrisome. COVID, of course, did cause exits to be delayed. Now, again, I'm always cautious about using our own succession data. I'll tell you a story why. I remember, you know, it's classic for business owners to have a, you know, a rough time frame of when they'd like to leave their business. But then that day comes closer and the business owner says, yeah, I think I got another 5 years in me. And then and then that 5 years passes and they say, yeah, I think I got another 5 years in me. That's a classic story that does happen many, many times over, in part because the business owner can't think of anything else they'd rather do than run the business that they are so happy about having created. But time does run out. I mean, those five-year plans, that even if they get delayed, they can't get delayed indefinitely. And so we do have to be prepared for this, prepared better than where we are today. We're pushing for an increase in the lifetime capital gains exemption to help smooth that transition. The feds did, to their credit. It was a private member's bill, but the federal government did accept it finally, that will allow businesses to sell their businesses to relatives, to their children or others, at the same tax treatment as if they were selling it to a stranger. That was a major obstacle for many businesses that wanted to keep the business in the family.
Right.
This is so important, though, for the economy, because we want to make sure that business owners can successfully pass the business to someone else. If we don't, many Canadian business owners say, look, I don't want to sell my business to the U.S. hedge fund that's coming and looking at it or an entrepreneur from elsewhere, because I know that they're looking to buy me for my client list or my product. And as a result, when I sell, the business itself may disappear or disappear at least from the region. And I remember talking to, you know, Bathurst, New Brunswick business owner that was saying, you know, I've got a great offer. I don't want to sell to this guy because I know the company's going to disappear in Bathurst once the minute I do that. Business owners are often really proud of the employment that they've created, the economic generation that happens in their community, the support that they're able to provide to local community groups and organizations. It's funny, many business owners start out with a profit orientation, but that changes often once you've been in business for a period of time. You worry about making sure that the business can succeed you. And so it's a wonderful thing, a huge insulating effect to the economy as well. This is where, of course, as we spoke about just briefly, more international entrepreneur streams of immigration can really help. We have to make sure we're doing it right so that we just don't provide a pathway for people that, you know, create a business for 2 minutes so that they can get immigration status and then shut her down. But if we can do that right, new immigrants to Canada, permanent immigrants to Canada, can be a huge source of they often come, unlike in the past, they come armed with capital to be able to buy companies in the regions and keep them going as going concerns, and that business can live on another day. So we need to make sure that we're looking at all of the variables that will help businesses successfully transition from one generation to the next. It's a big worry and should be a bigger worry on the part of public policymakers. I don't think it's really cracked through, though, in Ottawa.
Right. So final question, speaking of generational changes, Atlantic Canada is witnessing unprecedented population growth, as you know. And by unprecedented, in the last 5 years, population has grown more than any time in the history of the region, to put it in perspective. So now I guess the question is, you know, what does this really mean for your CBI, CFIB members in the region?
Look, I am of the school that would be thrilled if Canada can itself become a larger country. I would be thrilled if we can continue to keep population growth at a fairly broad, quick clip. But of course, we have to. I acknowledge that we have to make sure that we're doing it in a smart way, that we can keep services up and housing up to be able to accommodate new Canadians. I think this is one of the reasons why we should be optimistic. Canada remains a destination of choice for many, many from around the world. We have been successful, increasingly successful in getting new immigrants to look beyond Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver. This is where the temporary foreign worker program does a really nice job. It can, it brings in an immigrant for a specific job in a specific region. Once they lay down some roots in that region, they've worked there a couple of years, they realize, hey, this small town has a hospital and has a good school. I don't need to go to the big city like I might have in India or in the Philippines or in Iran. And so these kinds of things, I'm from Manitoba, and Manitoba totally changed the face of the province by being the earliest adopter of a small province of embracing immigration for labor market needs. And I got to tell you, when I go back to my hometown of Winnipeg, it is a very different place than it was growing up. And I think that that's super exciting. The diversity that that has brought in terms of the business strength has been also enormously helpful, an opportunity for people to transition their business to more hands, companies that are laying down roots and growing. We spend so much time and attention trying to buy businesses from other jurisdictions to come to Canada and set up shop. I would rather bring in people that set up businesses in those local communities. Those are the ones, like if every small company created one job, it's going to eclipse any the impact of a battery plant that we're given $7 billion in subsidies to. So right. This is why I think it is really exciting to see what's happening in Atlantic Canada. I know it's creating some pressures from a housing perspective, government services perspective. I think we got to manage them better, but not stop this fuel to the economy that is needed. It can benefit small companies with new customers and potential successors. This is great news for the long-term growth of Atlantic Canada and the nation as a whole.
Well, Dan, I'd like to thank you for coming on to the Insights podcast, telling us more about the work of CFIB. And I also want to congratulate both the organization and you yourself for being such a great advocate for small businesses in Canada. That voice is really important. And I encourage other small businesses to become a member of CFIB because of the important advocacy work that you do on behalf of those businesses. So thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, John. It was a great opportunity for us.
Listen to past episodes on your favorite podcast platform, like Apple or Spotify. If you've enjoyed the show, why not recommend it to a friend? Don and David will be back next week with another deep dive into some key issues in Atlantic Canada.